from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, Google's $12.5 billion gamble, acquiring Motorola's cell phone business. On the surface, it's the search engine giant's move into smartphones. But analysts agree it's also about Motorola's 17,000-plus patents. Not because Google wants the innovation behind those patents, but rather to protect itself against lawsuits. In this hour of Forum, patent wars. How patent infringement lawsuits now threaten Silicon Valley's biggest players and how they're defending themselves. We'll get started with Forum right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office marked a milestone yesterday, issuing its 8 millionth patent for a visual prosthesis that helps people who've gone blind from retinal degeneration see better. Well, once upon a time, patents were all about protecting inventors and innovation. But these days, patents are used as a kind of weapon in a legal arms race, especially among tech companies. In fact, Google CEO Larry Page says his company's $12.5 billion purchase of Motorola's mobile phone business this week was largely about acquiring more than 17,000 patents that Motorola owns. So what's driving this patent arms race in Silicon Valley and beyond? Joining us this hour to talk about it are Laura Seidel. She's a digital culture correspondent for National Public Radio. She also reported on patent wars with Planet Money for All Things Considered and This American Life. Laura, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott.
Also here, Ron Epstein. He's the CEO of Epicenter IP Group, LLC. They manage patent licensing transactions. Ron Epstein, good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone this morning, Paul Schneck, who is chairman of Rembrandt IP Management. They acquire patents and bring enforcement actions against infringing companies. Paul Schneck, good morning to you, too.
Thank you. Good morning.
And also joining us by phone this morning is James Besson. He's a lecturer at Boston University Law School in Boston. Good morning. Let me begin with you, Laura Seidel, if I can. I learned in social studies that, as I said at the top, you know, patents were all about protecting inventors and, encouraging innovation, that kind of thing. You found in your reporting that it's really a lot more complicated than that. Describe what you found.
Well, I want to start by saying that, yes, patents are in the Constitution, and the idea is, really, they're not about protecting inventors so much as they are about benefiting society by encouraging people to put their innovations out into the public so that other people can benefit by them. So, for example, Eli Whitney, he invents the cotton gin, but he might not want to tell everybody about how it works because then they're going to come and they're going to copy him and they'll make money. So we give him a 20-year monopoly during which he can charge people who use his ideas. And that way, we can all benefit because 20 years later, everybody can benefit and build on his ideas. So the idea really is to benefit society by giving this opportunity, this special monopoly.
So to encourage them to share what they've learned and what they've discovered.
Exactly. That's really the core of patents. It's really not about, like, how can we help inventors? It's really about helping society. That's really the core of what's behind it. And I think many people say now what's happening, particularly in the area of software patents, is that it's starting to do the opposite. What we discovered, we looked at a company called Intellectual Ventures. Intellectual Ventures was founded by Nathan Myhrvold, who is the former CTO of Microsoft. And he came up with the idea of creating a company that he said was all about supporting inventors. And so they went out and they started to buy up patents from all kinds of inventors and amass them together so that other companies could come to his company and say, we're going to license some of your patents, and then we'll go out and make them. That's a great idea, I guess, if all the patents are good. What we began to find, particularly in the area of software patents, was that many of the patents were really broad, really, really vague. And I know Jim Besson is on the line, so I'm actually going to sort of quote some of your reasoning, Jim, which is that, say, if patents are property, they're intellectual property, but they're a property, right? So when you have a piece of property, you need to know what the boundaries are. You need to be really clear. If you don't, what happens? Israel and Palestine, right? You have wars. With a lot of software patents, it seems like they're very vague and very broad. And so it becomes
deliberately.
I think many people would say yes, deliberately. And in fact, many of the software engineers I talked to didn't even understand their own patents and told me that lawyers would come in and say, yeah, you did this, you did that. And I mean, I had in the reporting I did, and he wasn't the only one who said it, but I had one or two software engineers, and I've talked to others who've said the same thing, where they don't even understand their own patents. They're not particularly proud of their patents. They were encouraged to do it. I think in part a lot of companies feel, and we're going to get to Google shortly, that they need a huge patent portfolio just to protect themselves from lawsuits.
So Ron Epstein, is it Epstein or Epstein, by the
Epstein.
Way? Epstein. Thank you. I'm glad I asked. You helped coin this phrase, patent trolls, which Laura, you described in your reporting for Planet Money. Explain what you mean by a patent troll and this company, Intellectual Ventures. Say a little bit more about it. How do they go about doing what they do, and what impact are they having on innovation?
Well, let's break that down into two parts. Where the term patent troll came from, interestingly, was a contest we had in the Intel legal department back in the late 90s to come up with a pejorative we could use to put, you know, to cast aspersion on people who have the audacity to assert patents against us. I mean, there's good economic reasons for that as well, right? Intel's trying to reduce, and all large companies are trying to reduce the level of patent assertion against them. So anything in that battle kind of makes sense. But it is a specifically designed term to convey a specific emotional message. Companies like Intellectual Ventures, companies like RPX, which recently went public, companies like my company at Epicenter IP Group, we're basically the response to the market of the transition of the innovation marketplace from a niche, almost invisible business into a mainstream part of the overall technology market.
So explain what you mean by that.
So large corporations, you know, corporations have basically reduced their R&D budget over the last decade, two decades, right? No one can argue with that. So while they're reducing their R&D budget, the pace of innovation hasn't slowed down. In fact, if anything, it's increased, right? I mean, I don't think a week goes by without an even better smartphone coming out than the one I bought the week before, right? So if the pace of innovation is increasing, but people are reducing the amount of money they're spending on R&D, where is that innovation coming from? Answer, from outside that company, right? We've coined a term at Epicenter IP Group, innovation by observation. There's an awful lot of, gee, that feature over there in that product looks really cool to me, and I think I'll go ahead and bring that into my product, okay? So some of that innovation occurs from at large companies, and some of that innovation occurs, believe it or not, notwithstanding the lore of America, it still occurs individuals sitting in their homes or in their small offices.
So let me just stop you there. So that innovation they like and they decide to incorporate,
sure.
There's a patent on that innovation.
Rarely, but occasionally, yes, there is a patent on that occasion.
And so these patent trolls then, what role do they play in going after a company that might, you know, adopt that innovation?
Well, the term patent troll refers to a business I call the patent investor business. So we all, you know, take the emotion out of it. They're a classic arbitrage. I mean, like any market, when patents were worth more than nothing, obviously, there are patents, they're real inventions that people have written good patents on, and those things are worth more than nothing. Okay. The large corporations or the people who were infringing them were paying nothing. What these patent investors did is come in and say, look, I'll pay you something and I have the economic resources necessary to convert that asset into value. There was a big hole in the market. These patent investors filled it.
Uh-huh. Jim Bresson, what does your research show about the impact that all these patents have on the software business, on Silicon Valley, on innovation, those kinds of things?
So the impact varies by industry, and one of the things we find, we have ways of measuring both the benefits of patents and the costs of patents, at least the costs in terms of litigation costs, and not just legal costs of litigation, but, you know, when a company is sued, there is lost business, there's diverted resources and all sorts of secondary losses. We find that in chemicals and pharmaceuticals, those industries have benefits from the patent system that far outweigh the costs of litigation and disputes. We find that until the mid-90s, it was kind of a break-even for many other industries, including tech or information technology industries. But starting in the mid-90s, the litigation rates and the cost of litigation started going through the roof. We have three times as many patent lawsuits being filed recently as we had in the late 80s. And the cost associated with these has also gone up.
And what changed? And so was there a tipping point?
I think there were several changes, most of them legal changes. The courts embarked on what was really a radical experiment. And I think history will look back on that period as being sort of a very radical break in the history of the patent system and possibly the history of the U.S. But they did many things, including making it much easier to get patents on software, on business methods. They really changed the rules for things about how the boundaries of a patent are interpreted, how vague a patent claims can be. And these things had a cumulative effect combined with a couple practices that allowed inventors to essentially keep patent applications open at the patent office and change the claim language after they witnessed products being produced that might fall under the ambit of the patent. Changes having to do just with the sheer numbers of patents, which, you know, in the tech industry, when you have, I think Google claims 250,000 patents that read on a cell phone, it's impossible to know, it's infeasible to check all of those patents. First off, you can't understand necessarily what they cover and what they mean, and the task is just too huge in terms of what it would cost in legal time to read through 250,000 patents and check your technology.
But
the result is,
go ahead.
We get disputes and we get litigation.
Paul Schneck, let me bring you into this. Your company acquires patents and brings enforcement action. So, how do you go about that, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, we look for patents that are fundamental in their area and that are high quality. Since we're business, of course, that are widely infringed as well. And in those contexts, we go back to what Lord Seidel mentioned as the original intent in the Constitution, which was a trade to promote it. The Constitution talks about promoting the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to inventors exclusive rights to their discoveries. And the inventor is encouraged to publish his or her idea in exchange for a limited right. What's happened is inventors have been squeezed out in the marketplace because they don't have the ability to, in essence, to rent their property. It's as if squatters came into their properties and just sat down and never paid rent. So we work with inventors and we cooperate with them, and we go after those squatters to obtain the rent on their behalf, and we share in that, and they share with us in the rewards, which are the royalties on their patents.
Laura Seidel, Paul Schneck sounds like the good guy here.
Well, I guess I don't know about the patents that you have, but I guess some people probably would use the derogatory term and call your company a patent troll. One of the things that we discovered in this investigation that we did, Intellectual Ventures, which many people say is the largest patent troll, gave us a patent to look at. They gave us an inventor by the name of Chris Crawford, and they said, here's an example of an inventor that we helped. He couldn't get money for his idea. Well, we went and we looked at the patent, and it turned out they had sold it to a firm that called Oasis Research, which did nothing, as far as we could tell, other than bring lawsuits. They had an office in Marshall, Texas. Marshall, Texas has a lot. Basically, it's where a lot of patent suits are brought. Some people say it's because the courts are friendly there to them. There are a variety of reasons. But there are halls of empty offices of companies that are incorporated there simply to bring lawsuits. And they have these patents, like Chris Crawford's patent, many of them, which are very vague. Chris Crawford's patent was for basically kind of the way they described it to me. What they said was essentially, when you go online and your software is updated, you know, you see that thing, you know, can we update that? He invented that. Well, we went, we looked, and we talked to patent experts, and it turns out that when he patented that, it was pretty much the industry standard. Everyone was doing it. There were also really like thousands of patents for almost the same thing. And so this company was going out and enforcing a patent that really didn't seem terribly good. And Jim talked about, you know, some of the issues in the 90s that allowed this to happen. The patent office was kind of pushed into granting these business method and software patents by the courts. And I think a lot of the examiners, at least from what we could tell, really weren't clear on what it was they were giving patents to begin with. So these very vague patents.
Ron Epstein, who's making money off of this? I mean, companies, these, whether you call them patent trolls or whatever, value added, however you want to describe what they do, is it the inventor, the Chris Crawfords of the world, who are they just making a little bit of money and then the real money comes from the lawsuits, the patent infringement lawsuits that get leveled against these companies?
Well, so like I was saying, this is an arbitrage situation, right? Folks like Rembrandt, folks like Intellectual Ventures, you know, these guys are in business to make money. What they see is an economic opportunity, which are these pieces of property. Okay, maybe, you know, in real property, it would be a piece of property over by the 101 over here. But an intellectual property, a valuable piece of property, would be a patent that a lot of people have – whose invention has been adopted, and they buy them. And they buy them, which gives the inventor more than nothing, right? You know, the challenge, and I think this is what the gentleman from Rembrandt was trying to get at, the challenge is with intellectual property, you can't lock your door, you can't close the gate, you can't call the police and get them to escort the trespasser off the property. The only way to protect your intellectual property is in the court system. And for good reasons or bad, that is an incredibly expensive proposition. So the investors do, I think, make a majority of the return, but they also make a huge capital outlay as well.
So Paul Schnack, what influence do you think you have on innovation?
Well, right now, to go back to something that Jim mentioned before, I would paraphrase it as the nation is eating its seed corn. For a company, perhaps it's innovation by observation, but for the nation, it's innovation without replenishing and reseeding the field for the next set of crops. So what we do is create the marketplace so that inventors have an incentive to continue to invent. Major inventions have been produced by small numbers of people, not huge groups and huge corporations, although they claim many patents. Inside those corporations are the wombs that nurture small teams of inventors. And those inventors, whether in corporations or operating as individuals, need to have a motive. Again, as corporations, they have motives. As individuals, we help give them that motive by acquiring their patents. And we share. We made multimillionaires out of our first patent owners after their patent went to trial, and we got a large judgment, which was split with the owners. So that provides an innovation for the next generation of inventors to say, wow, instead of the asymmetry where companies with lots of money exchange patent portfolios back and forth, I can invent something and I can see a recovery in the future. And I think I'd like to do that as my life's work.
Jim Besson, do you see it that way?
Not at all. So we've done an empirical study. We found that from 1990 through October of 2010, the lost wealth that patent troll lawsuits imposed on businesses in the U.S. Was over $500 billion. We also looked at how much of that money ended up going into the pockets of inventors, independent and small inventors. And an upper bound estimate puts the figure at about 2%. Very, very little of the money is going to the original inventors, the money that the wealth that is lost. On the other hand, the large companies who are being sued are tech companies. And so these are cases largely where it's inadvertent infringement, where they can't anticipate these lawsuits. It's very rarely a case of copying. So the effect of these very expensive lawsuits is to reduce the incentives for these large companies to invest in innovation themselves. It also reduces the incentives for large companies to license technologies from small inventors. Because why? Because if I'm a large company and I license a technology from a small inventor, and I'm going to get sued by some patent troll somewhere, I'm going to have less money that I can make on the product, and therefore I can pay the small inventor less.
Let's bring it back. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, finish up.
Finally, you have to ask, what kind of incentives are you providing to the inventors? Are these incentives to really come up with innovations, or are these incentives to come up with these vague patents on things like, quote, information manufacturing machines, or patents that claim updating of software, or patents that claim credit card transactions, very obvious things, very vague things, you're creating all the wrong sorts of incentives. This has very little to do with powering the economy of the U.S. It has very much to do with inhibiting the innovation in the U.S.
Let's bring it back to the Google-Motorola deal. Ron Epstein, what is it about Google that makes it so vulnerable? Why does it need all of these patents that Motorola has to protect itself?
Well, 4 years ago, Google wasn't in the mobile industry, right? The mobile, nor was it really in the computing industry. It had a particular fantastic search engine and a great advertising model. Well, now it's moved very heavily into the mobile industry. It's moved very heavily into the computing industry. Those industries today are the result of decades of research and innovation where people spent billions of dollars, you know, researching the inventions that deliver those industries. So here's Google moving into that industry, and the players in that industry want to return on that investment. Google, listen, you're a fabulous company. Love Android, but, right? Number one, maybe I'm Apple, maybe I'm Microsoft, maybe I'm RIM. I'm trying to compete with your Android based on innovation, and I'm watching my innovations show up in your product. Mm-hmm. And two, maybe I'm Nokia or some other company, and I may or Ericsson, and I may not be competing with you, but you're making use of my decades of innovation in your product. In both cases, Google has to pay for that innovation.
So that sounds like a very legitimate claim.
Sure. I spent 6 years at Intel Corporation, you know, running the patent licensing program, and this was the problem we were facing in the 90s when the PC market was emerging, is the same problem Google and Apple and Samsung are facing in the mobile computing market today.
So, Laura Seidel, is there a difference then between what Ron Epstein just described in the claim against Google and Android versus these other kind of smaller entrepreneurs who are being besieged in some cases? By these patent troll, as you call them, lawsuits?
I want to make a distinction here. There are different kinds of patents, and I think Jim made that point earlier, for example, pharmaceutical patents, which really seem to do what they're supposed to do. And then there are patents for people who invent a particular technical thing, perhaps chips are a good example. Then there are software patents. And in that package that they're buying from Motorola, and a lot of what Google's talking about are software patents. And I think that it's a very mixed bag, that package that we're talking about. And it's distinctly possible that many people would probably argue that a lot of the patents in that package are probably not going to be good patents. Google is not buying those patents for their technical secrets. In the world of software, and I think this is really important to understand, if you talk to software engineers, it's very incremental. It's not like there are these huge breakthroughs. And so I think the question becomes as to whether or not Google was really buying things to protect itself just from lawsuits on things that maybe really they shouldn't have been patented to begin with. And I think that you have to look at. That's where we see perhaps a lot of waste. And Google spent, I mean, what did they just spend on this? How many billions of dollars? An enormous amount of money.
12.5. Oh, yeah. Laura Seidel, digital culture correspondent with NPR. We'll have much more with her and our other guests in the rest of this hour as we explore the world of patents and patent trolling. Our number to call here if you want to join us. We'd love to hear from you, in particular if you work in Silicon Valley or in the innovation business, if you're a startup company or an inventor yourself. 866-733-6786. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. We're talking about patents. The Google-Motorola deal this week, $12.5 billion, a big move by Google into the smartphone market, but also it's about Motorola's patents, and we're discussing what it is about software patents that are making them so valuable these days. Our guests right here with me in the studio, Laura Seidel, digital culture correspondent for NPR. She's reported on these patent wars with Planet Money for All Things Considered and This American Life. Also here, Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP Group, LLC. They manage patent licensing transactions. And joining us by phone, Jim Besson. He is a lecturer at the Boston University School of Law. And Paul Schneck, he's chairman of Rembrandt IP Management, which acquires patents and brings enforcement actions against companies that infringe those patents. If you want to join us this morning, again, the number 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org. Just before the break, Laura Seidel, you were talking about the difference between software patents and hardware patents, and that many of those software patents maybe shouldn't have been issued. What are your thoughts about that, Ron Epstein?
Yeah, I couldn't disagree with Laura anymore. her fundamental comment, which is there are lots of little inventions in software that are incremental. That's true in every industry, right? But fundamentally, what is different about software that makes it less patentable? The example I like to use is there's no one who can argue that Alexander Graham Bell wasn't entitled to a patent on the invention of the telephone. That was done with wires and batteries and switches, right? Voice over IP, which is the technology most of our phones are moving to, is implemented on a general purpose computer with software. What is it about changing the switching technology from a special purpose switch to using a general purpose microprocessor and having the software doing the switching that suddenly makes it unpatentable? I don't see the distinction there. You know, I think this is more a question on the impact of the invention as opposed to the technology it's implemented in.
Quick comment from Laura.
Well, I actually want to say, ask if Jim had a comment about that.
Jim Besson?
Yeah, so it's true that some software patents can be described in terms that are technically equivalent to hardware patents. But what we have is, it's not only that we have software patents, it's that a lot of the other requirements about software have been very relaxed. So we get these very vaguely worded, very expansive patents that can cover everything. Remember, software is more abstract, so you get these very abstract ideas that get patented. We looked at, Mike and Moyer and I looked at one patent, the famous e-data patent, which the inventor invented something useful originally. It was a kiosk that was in a retail store where you could insert your credit card and create a little tape to play on your 8-track cassette player back then. They worded it with words like information manufacturing machine and point-of-sale location, very vague and expansive things. Later on, this was acquired by a patent troll who interpreted that patent on a kiosk to cover an awful lot of e-commerce. Well, clearly the inventor hadn't invented e-commerce, but he had worded this patent in a way that was extremely broad. As a result, we had 43 lawsuits. We had hundreds of companies who paid licensing fees for this. A lot of disputes, a lot of confusion in the marketplace.
Well, there's discussion.
This is the problem with software patents.
There's discussion about changing the rules, changing the law, patent reform, and so on. Would that address some of these problems?
The problems are getting addressed to some degree. The Supreme Court had a decision last year in the Bilski case, which reined in some of these excesses. But I think they've got a lot farther to go.
All right. Let's bring our listeners in now. Let's go to San Francisco. Mark is on the line. Mark, welcome.
Hi there. As an individual inventor, I'm certainly motivated by the fact that I can get a patent. But I have to comment on the differences between this and companies that buy huge portfolios of patents. And I think that if you read particularly what they've written about how they feel about the patents and their collection of them, they don't actually really care about any one patent. What they're doing is a little bit like mining the sea with lots of mines, so that any enterprise or anybody who's trying to do anything will hit one of these mines and have to deal with them. So there seems to me to be a very big difference between collections of patents being used to used not for innovation, but to get a business deal, and patents that are actually designed to be made.
Paul Schneck, are you mining the seas with these patents, waiting to blow up companies that use
No, I think just
I think just the opposite, in that what we are doing is buying individual patents, not huge portfolios. But Mark brings up an interesting example. Let's follow that just a little bit further, because these large companies that buy large portfolios of patents, not looking at any individuals, they simply don't have time to look through thousands of patents and understand, let alone read them in any great detail. So what they do is they prepare to cross-license their patent portfolios with their competitors who have other patent portfolios. They cross-license those portfolios typically for no money and simply for the exchange and agreement that they will not sue one another on those patents. Now, if you or I were to barter goods and I were to say, barter a computer and you return to me a cell phone, we would need to declare that exchange and transaction on our IRS 1040 returns and pay taxes on it. Somehow, when these huge corporations do that, there are no tax influences here because no money has changed hands. And that's an asymmetry with the small inventor who is not in a position to barter a huge portfolio. He or she or they have only one or two patents, and where they're fundamental, they are ignored. Most of the patents that we see come to us after the inventors have approached companies and have been told, no, there's no infringement, no, your patent's not valid, or just try us and sue us. It's going to cost a lot of money. You won't be able to do anything. Wink, wink. And so that's an asymmetry in the marketplace that we're trying to correct.
Laura Seidel, so Paul Schneck is saying they're kind of trying to level the playing field here.
You know, I really don't doubt that there are inventors out there who have very valid inventions who have been taken advantage by large corporations. And I think I have no idea what patents Mr. Schneck holds. I mean, they may be very, very good patents. I think a lot of what we looked at is that a lot of them aren't good. And this idea that you spend billions and billions of dollars to build up this patent portfolio for the only reason really is to defend yourself against lawsuits. It's kind of troubling. It seems like an enormous waste of money. And I think somehow or other, we have to make sure that the patents that are in these portfolios are really meaningful patents.
Ron Epstein, you're shaking your head.
Yeah. You know, people don't build up huge portfolios of patents to avoid lawsuits. There's this huge confusion, right, that lawsuits are the purpose. They're not the purpose, right? The purpose is, in an innovation-based economy, people compete based on innovation, right? Apple's very proud of its innovation and would desire that its competitors not copy it, right? So they're looking at, let's say they're looking at a company like Google and saying, Google, don't use my innovation when you're competing with me. I'm delighted to be competed with, but don't use my innovation. In fact, I believe they've issued press releases to that effect in their lawsuit with HTC. Well, okay, so if you've got a company like Apple saying, don't use my innovation, there are three choices you get to make. One is you stop using the innovation. The second is you pay for it. And the third is you develop your own pool of innovation, which the company that's asking you to pay for their innovation to trade with them, right? Google bought these patents because, as fantastic a company as they are, as fantastic a set of innovators as they are, they didn't own a pool of innovation which other companies really wanted or needed access to.
So it's been described by some as sort of mutually assured destruction. You know, that you have your missiles in the form of patents. We have our missiles in the form of other patents. We won't sue you if you don't sue us. Is that what's going on?
Well, without doubt that the language around patent licensing in large corporations follows the same language of nuclear disarmament. In theory, we've used mutual assured destruction. We've used, you know, patent peace and various other kinds of terms. But the fundamental underlying principle is this. Each of those companies wants their engineers to be free to follow what the market asks for, even if that means copying a feature that they see in a competitor's product. And to be free to do that, they need to have something, some coin to pay the innovator. And that's why these large corporations are building large patents.
Laura said that.
I go back to Jim's research and some of the things that I found, which I'm, you know, this is the thing, is that what we found is that so many of the patents that we are talking about probably should never have been granted in the first place. There is a patent on toast, and it was issued in 2000 by our patent office. So something is off, and I think this is the part that I'd love to see. I actually would love to go through some of these patent portfolios and have an expert look at these patents and tell me how many of them are really good patents.
All right, let's bring our listeners in. Jeff is on the line from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to go to the comment that one of your guests made, a great program, by the way, about pharmaceutical patents working well. And I just had an interesting discovery about a drug called colchicine, which is for gout. That's an old drug, and it had cost pennies for many, many years. Recently, it went off market as a generic and has been branded as Colchris and patented, and is costing about $5 a pill. And I just am really curious as to why we're allowed to see patents be used kind of against the public when something's been really, you know, community property practically speaking.
Jim Besson, I think it was you who said that the pharmaceutical and chemical industry patents were working rather well, but we do see that pharmaceutical companies kind of coming up with a different use for a drug that's about to go off patent, and suddenly it's back on on patents and expensive again.
Right. I didn't mean to imply that everything about the pharmaceutical industry or everything about the pharmaceutical patents are perfect. The pharma companies sometimes do stretch things a little bit, and I'm not familiar with the particular drug that the caller is talking about.
But we've seen that with, like, antidepressants, for example.
I'm not sure they could get a valid patent, but if, so they may have figured out some twist on it. The comparison, though, is nevertheless is still night and day in terms of the comparison between those sorts of patents and things like software patents. And the reason is the clear definition of boundaries.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is if I have a chemical, it may be a complex chemical, but I can get another chemist who can identify whether another substance is infringing. If I have a software product an operating system, and we have these patents that are vaguely worded and, you know, of possibly great scope or possibly narrow scope, it's impossible to tell whether I'm infringing or not when I develop a product.
And so what happens then?
I can go to a lawyer and get an opinion on that, but no lawyer is going to guarantee their opinion.
And so companies know that that they might lose, so they just decide to settle, basically?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So when you have these vague boundaries, the system opens up for opportunism. There are all sorts of opportunities to abuse the system. So even though I agree with Paul, that, you know, there are very clear all inventors who have important inventions and need to get out there, they are being swamped today by companies and also by patent trolls and others who are coming up with abusive patents that really are, you know, taking advantage of weaknesses in the patent system to abuse it for their own gain.
Ron Epstein.
Can I offer up a compromise that will get us all on the same page?
We're talking about compromise in the next hour, so maybe you'd like to stick around.
I heard that. Let's agree that there are an awful lot of bad patents. There are an awful lot of low-quality patents, given. That, I think, is a separate debate from where there are fundamental inventions which occur occasionally, and even more rarely those fundamental inventions are captured in a good quality, high, well-written, high-quality patent, that those are things that are worthy of value, and these things that are of low quality, yes. And let's not lose the value of the patent system in the debate over quality. There are ways to address quality, and in fact, the market is addressing quality. The Supreme Court has taken more patent cases in the last 7 years than they took in the previous 35. You know, this is an area where Congress is now making a second patent reform legislation in a decade. The market is trying to address these quality issues.
And what's the trend at the high court? Are they coming down on the side of the innovators or the companies that are allegedly infringing? I mean,
they're coming down on the side of trying to get more clarity and more precision in the system. Mm-hmm. Now, to true innovators, that's a good thing, right? To the kind of things that
Jim
about,
Besson.
People who own those lower quality patents, I think it's going to be problematic. And I'm a patent broker. I buy and sell patents. I don't just license them. And I'll tell you, in the last 5 years, we've seen the price of low-quality patents disappear down to zero, and we've seen the price of quality patents, ones I would define as someone with 20 years of experience in the industry, as meeting the definitions of clarity that Jim and Laura are talking about. The prices on those have tripled and quadrupled in the last couple of years.
So the marketplace is working, in your view?
That's what markets do.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a software engineer out there, you know, listening who's called in, because I'd really be curious to hear from somebody in that field.
Jeff, thanks for the call. It's another caller from Palo Alto, Becky. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, actually, my comment was sort of the same as, was it Jeff's or Jim's? I used to work for the pharmaceutical industry, and part of my job was to search patents, and I would find so many that looked practically identical. For example, the same antibody hitting the same receptor to make a drug, and then they would claim every possible disease that anybody could ever get. And so it just seemed to me like, why is it patented? And to me, it seemed kind of like in academia, it's publish or perish. Maybe in industry, it's patent or perish.
Uh-huh. And Jim Besson, are you finding that in your research, that kind of looking sort of the differences within the pharmaceutical industry? They're looking for the importance of looking for, you know, diseases, for example, that might meet the criteria for your patent or your discovery.
I should make an important distinction between the pharmaceutical industry, between small chemical, small molecules, and sort of more the biotech industry.
Oh, molecules, I would see the same thing. And
really?
Biotech pharma, they would, you know, add any possible
condition
or something.
Yeah,
and say, okay, we could add this one, 10,000.
Yes. They do a fencing strategy where they'll try to have all the different variants.
But it's not like they ever tried it.
Ron Epstein?
I don't know.
You know, the challenge with writing a patent, in 20 years of doing patent disputes, I've never seen an honest inquiry into the true inventorship of the underlying invention. They are, in the end, as Laura's pointed out, legal games, right? So when you're trying to enforce your intellectual property, people are much happier begging for forgiveness than asking for permission. So these disputes end not to be, did you really invent it? These disputes really end up being, hey, I can find a way to blow up your patent. As a consequence, people trying to develop quality patent portfolio really need to do an exhaustive fencing strategy. I mean, that's required if you want to ultimately defend your invention.
Silicon Valley for many years in the 70s and 80s was really the place where software and other high-tech innovation was happening. Has all of this changed that? I mean, is all these legal disputes, has it moved the epicenter for innovation elsewhere? Or has it had any impact on that? And I'm thinking even outside the country. I mean, what role, for example, how is China playing in all of this, if anyone knows that?
Well, I can't absolutely answer that question. I think you're starting to see more patents go on and more interest in intellectual property elsewhere. But I think a lot of people would say in software, before there were a lot of patents, there was plenty of innovation. And the concern is that because it's getting so expensive, because companies are spending all this money to acquire these patents, many of which are not good, and that you have these companies, these quote-unquote patent trolls, that it's going to actually be a drag on innovation ultimately.
Ron.
Hold
on one second. I'll get to you in a second,
So there's a reason why the U.S. Trade Representative pushes so hard for intellectual property protection in developing countries, right? That at the end of the day, if you're going to have an innovation-based economy, protection of innovation is pretty critical. As the U.S. moves from a manufacturing economy to a more innovation-based economy, the cost of manufacture is cheaper in other countries. The ability to take a look at a product, reverse engineer it, and reintroduce and a relatively identical copy within 3 to 6 months is very easy. So as a consequence, I think this growing internationalization has led to an increase in the value of patents.
Was that Jim? Did you want to jump in, or was it Paul Schneck?
Yeah, in terms, Paul in terms here. Of how, what is the effect? I think the original question was, what is the effect of these disputes on innovation in the Silicon Valley? Two things. One is, we're seeing some early evidence at the margins of people who are software developers from other countries who will no longer sell in the U.S. because of these problems. So, for instance, there's a recent patent troll suit by a company called Lodesys, which has been going after app developers. It's a very small market, but many of these app developers in other countries, in England and Europe, are deciding to withdraw their products from the U.S. so they won't have to deal with this patent troll.
Yeah,
the second thing is the effect of this, it acts as a tax on innovation. So it's not something that stops innovation. It's something that slows it down. It makes it more expensive.
So we wouldn't expect to see any sort of immediate effect, but it, you know, in the long run, it's going to reduce innovation, it's going to reduce jobs, it's going to reduce economic growth.
Ron Epstein, I don't know if you can respond to this, but, you know, as regulators look at this proposed deal between Google and Motorola, are they going to think, well, gee, it's better to have a U.S. company acquire these patents than, say, someone outside the United States? I keep mentioning China, but, you know, for example, China.
Yeah, I mean, Huawei, which is increasingly getting into the mobile computing as opposed to mobile phone business, you know, an entry into the U.S. having a strong patent portfolio would have been useful, too. Will the regulators look at this one way or another? I don't know whether that question comes up, because I think this acquisition is clearly pro-competitive from the perspective of giving Google a stronger ability to enter the market. But I would what your question does lead to is expect some more deals. I mean, there's a fever pitch in patent buying in the mobile computing industry, but this is going across the entire tech industry right now. This distraction over patent trolls, you know, in the entire history of patent trolls, I'd be shocked if the amount of money actually spent in the last decade equaled the $4.5 billion of the Nortel deal. There is clearly an economic reason why large corporations are getting into this business.
866-733-6786, the number to call if you want to join our conversation, or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Benjamin in San Francisco sends an email. He says, I'm a software engineer. I've worked at large software companies such as Sun. I'm an inventor of 12 patents. Patent examiners have no idea what they're reviewing, none. Someone patented Ohm's law, which is a fundamental law of physics, and it sailed right through. The smart kids are filing the patents, not reviewing them. Any thoughts about that? Is the patent office...
Benjamin is right on as Jim has pointed out, there really is difference between... Or as each of the guests has pointed out, there's a major difference between fundamental patents and, when we talk about software and business methods, more incremental patents. One of the reasons that happens is that computer science and information technology is a new technology. It does not yet have a long established literature base to which examiners can turn. It does not yet have a long established tradition of scholarship. 50 years may seem like a long time, but it really is not in something that's changing so rapidly. So the patent office has a hard time in distinguishing things, and as lawyers craft patents, they get things past the patent examiners sometimes, which in retrospect ought not to have gotten out. And patent quality and hiring more examiners and examiners with degrees and examiners who know the difference is a really important thing. And the new patent bill that you mentioned a few minutes ago, although it attempts to sequester monies brought in as fees by the patent office, fails, I think, to do that. And we need to worry about how the patent office will maintain and upgrade its ability to distinguish between true innovation and only pieces of paper. And that's a real, real problem.
And a related email from Matt in San Francisco, who asks, do judges have enough of an understanding of emerging technologies such as software or biotechnologies to make the best judgments when ruling on patent issues? Jim Besson?
Well, there are some discussions about having specialized district court level trial judges who specialize in patents. I think it's very difficult, and worse than judges, I think it's much more difficult to deal with juries.
Yeah, Laura Seidel, you mentioned that there are some districts, and you went down to Marshall, Texas, where there seem to be a lot of these patent cases. So what is it about? Why are there these clusters, do you think?
We were told many different things, but one of them was that the juries there tend to be friendlier to plaintiffs.
Meaning more malleable or more impressionable?
One thing some of the attorneys would say is once you bring out, I guess you get sort of a ribbon when you get a patent, or you get a certificate that maybe has a ribbon on it. You bring that out and the juries see this. And there's something about it where they are very sympathetic to the idea of, you know, property. I don't know for sure. This is one of the things that we heard down there. Also, the other thing we heard was that the drug wars kind of drove it there because all the other courts were full because the federal courts were filled with criminal cases. And so this particular court was not, and that's why there's so many there.
All right, let's try to get another call in here. Mark in Redwood City, welcome.
Hello. I'm an inventor with a large number of patents, and I'm in my second startup company, which has about 300 pending. And when I hear news of this type where we have a large patent estate selling for a large amount of money, it makes me smile because it's a lot easier to raise money if your patents are more valuable, and the perception of value is often determinative. And one can almost put down a price per patent, even if many of them or most of them are useless. It does make intellectual property perceived as more valuable in the marketplace, competing with other tangible goods such as gold or trees or something else, that it's more likely for people to want to invest in high tech again. And instead of the fighting over this, whether or not this or that patent is good or bad is useless. The point is, large companies are spending a very large amount of money on something that Silicon Valley does very well, which is creating intellectual property.
Ron Epstein sounds like a potential client for you here.
Yes, I'm in Redwood City too. You should give me a call.
Tell each other.
All right.
Oh, hey, Mark.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. So, just about a minute left here. Where do you see this going, Laura? Is the system going to change? Is Congress going to take up any meaningful reform, or maybe the market is taking care of itself, as Ron suggested?
Well, I guess when we look at Congress right now, it seems like they're very busy doing a lot of other things.
Or nothing.
Or nothing. I know that the president keeps talking about patents and patent reform and actually seems to be making it a priority. It does seem to me that the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, is starting to step in maybe and look at what's going on here. So I certainly don't have solutions. It did strike me in looking at this that we seem to have a terrible problem in the patent office in terms of some very bad things getting patented. I should add the gentleman who was just on, the problem is if his company goes under, gets sold, that's when they say the patent trolls come in, for example, buy up those patents and go around and sue.
It's like a probate sale.
Yeah.
All right. Laura Seidel, digital culture correspondent for National Public Radio. Thanks for being here this morning. Thanks also to Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP Group. Paul Schneck joining us from back east. He's the chairman of Rembrandt IP Management. And Jim Besson, a lecturer at Boston University School of Law. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Rob Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.